enough. Anyway, there was a scene where something wonderful happened, and his wife, and he gave a big hug, and they fell onto the couch. And there was, I mean, this is 1958 or 59, so, you know, we still have the Catholic Film Commission and all the film ratings and all that stuff, and they controlled all of it. And Sister Petra, my sixth or fifth grade teacher, whatever it was, put her hand over the lens because she was sure it was going to be terrible. And I remember Sister Annette going, "Oh, Sister Petra, come on." And she was just a really gentle, kind teacher. And of course, she also let me go to on the trip, the 2 or 3 week trip back to Kings Point in the middle of the school year, I don't know, sixth or seventh grade. Because Dad had, as part of the court case, he had to go back. And we talked about, I remember we talked about this, because we would take him out to Los Angeles International Airport, and we would walk out the concourse after there was some kind of a building with tickets and stuff, and then you would walk out, and they had chain link fence about 4 feet high with a canopy over it, and it was all open air. And you would walk down, it was, you know, maybe 10 or 15 feet wide, and you would walk down to the gate, which had a sliding chain link gate. And then you would walk out to the airplane and go up a set of steps. Now, I mean, and in fairness, I mean, you know, it's Long Beach, it's California, so the only reason it was covered, you know, was to cover you for the, you know, the little bit of rain they got. And I remember getting on a Super Constellation, a TWA, and on a United DC-7 and a DC-6.
Now, did you have to pay for that, or
was it kind of a they paid the, I guess they collected money, because there were 95 members of the class action suit.
Okay.
So they helped pay for that, because he was the prime plaintiff, and was all, I mean, he had folders, multiple folders, 2-3 inches thick with correspondence and all that kind of stuff.
No, Mr. Irving
would
like to.
And, so he would normally fly back, and when, I mean, that was expensive. But otherwise, it was a 2.5 day, it was 40 hours. You could make LA to Chicago in 39.5 hours on a Santa Fe. But then you had another overnight trip, or a full day trip from Chicago to Pennsylvania, to Washington. So what was it, 40 hours? You were looking at two and a half days to get there. So, I mean, he's going to school, and he's or working. So, anyway, he knew he was going back for a hearing at the U.S. Court. They had eventually made it to the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., which that's as high as you can go, because this was it was a civil matter dealing with it was the U.S. Court of Claims. That's what it was. And the U.S. Court of Claims is the one who dealt with all suits involving claims against the United States. Right, and they were suing for money, and after the Court of Claims, it would go to the Supreme Court. So I don't know what all the intermediate steps were to get to the U.S. Court of Claims, but I mean, it was a seven-judge panel, because anyway, he was going back there with a specific
hearing.
I guess, I think what it was then, they were actually doing the arguments, just like you do in the Supreme Court, where each one goes and argues their cases and so on and so forth. And at a specified date, and we had made reservations on the Santa Fe, I believe. Or anyway, whichever was taking us, LA to Chicago, and then Chicago on the Penzi to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And
why did you think
that? Well, they were taking, well, she was in high school, so getting her out of high school for 2 weeks probably was an issue. I don't know if there were any other issues. I don't know if she had any other, she'd had any trips back or not, to be honest with you. But she was in high school, which would have been tougher to get out of. And they call up and they change the date. They move it up. Because I was in class.
Uh-huh.
It was March, maybe late February, March. And I remember Dad coming in, talking to Sister Annette, and there had been some arrangements and discussions about it, obviously, because I was going to miss some class. And they literally took me out of school at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We went down to Sears, and they bought a winter coat, which was quite a chore in California back then. But they got me a bright red parka. I mean, I felt like, wow. I mean, because, you know, we were going around in, you know, like a cloth jacket. I mean, you didn't need much of anything. And they took me down, got me the red parka. I don't know if they bought anything else I needed. We packed, I guess my mother packed the bag. I wasn't really ready to pack a bag at that point. And we went into L.A. that evening, got on the Sunset Limit. They could not, the trains were full. At least, I don't know if he was going to get a Pullman then or not. Was it pay for a plane ticket? They probably would have paid for a Pullman ticket. They didn't pay for them. But anyway, we get on the Sunset Limited out of L.A. to New Orleans. And from New Orleans,
but
so...
That way you had friends and brothers.
Yep. Because we, I remember the trip well, because there was a black guy that Dad spent a lot of time talking to, and we were in a coach. So maybe he used the money that he would have had anyway, because you went pretty cheap as a kid back then.
Right.
You'd go for like quarter or half fare.
Uh-huh.
But we went coach, and I remember going through El Paso because we were eating dinner in the diner. And
on the train?
On the train, oh yeah. Well, yeah, diners are real. And I asked for iced tea, and I put cream and lemon in it. Because I like tea with both, but
ew.
I never mixed them. It was iced tea.
Ew.
They brought me another. And my dad said, what are you doing? I like lemon and milk. I didn't know about curdling. And then I remember we stopped in San Antonio we were in San Antonio the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was disappointed because you couldn't see the Alamo from the train station. Of course, I've since been back to the train station, and you're only about 4 blocks away, but we didn't have enough time to go. And
so you went from California to Texas to New York?
There was no direct trains to Chicago or whatever on to get there.
Okay.
So we went, the Sunset Limited went from L.A. to New Orleans.
And then from New Orleans?
Well, then no, we went. We got into New Orleans at like 5 in the afternoon. The sun was just setting because we went over the big Mississippi River Railroad bridge and stuff. And of course, this black guy is now, New Orleans is where I saw my first black-only drinking fountain. Beautiful train station. I remember a lot of marble and stuff, and I guess it's still there. It was when we went by and we drove by it. I probably should have gone in. But yeah, that's. Of course, then I got to Montgomery, and then you had separate lunchrooms and stuff. But then we had like 3 hours to kill to take, because then you took the Louisville and Nashville. Been in dinner time, and I remember Dad getting in. We got into the cab, and my father. I don't know if Dad knew about the Court of the Two Sisters, or if he asked the taxi driver, you know, which would be a good place to go to eat. Whatever criteria he gave him, he took us to the Court of the Two Sisters. And I remember, the court, when we went back, both times.
We went with you.
And I guess we did not go with Joe because we didn't, when we probably should have. When we went from, when I was in the Army going from Fort Benning to Huachuca, we spent 1 or 2 days in New Orleans, but we didn't go to the Court of the Two Sisters, we should have. But we figured with Joe and stuff, it wouldn't be a, but we sat outside. My father had red snapper, and I had fried shrimp, which remember the food.
Not
but that fountain that's there,
uh-huh.
I mean, it was like we had never left. Was that 30 years later? 40 years later.
40, okay, it might have been 50.
This would have been 58 or so, almost 40 years later, it hadn't changed. We got on the train, went through Biloxi because all of a sudden a whole bunch of Air Force guys got on to Keesler. And I woke up the next morning and we were in Montgomery, Alabama. The trains would come in and you would set, and if you were lucky, you wouldn't have to, you'd leave the cars there and they'd hook them up to a steam line. And then, because it got off, when I woke up, we got off and there was a lunchroom, white only. The railroad station, of course, you can see the Capitol of Montgomery, the Capitol building is right up the hill. And we went from there to Atlanta. We went to a pretty good, he asked one of the conductors where they go to eat, so we went to like a cafeteria. And then on the train, we got to Atlanta, probably like maybe midday, and then we left later, and we left three hours later on the Southern Railroad from Atlanta to Washington. And I remember that because we sat with a really pretty college-age girl, because I mean, sure, you can't just sit at the table. Really pretty. Had a crush on her. I guess it was as much as you have in seventh grade, eighth grade. And I had this ham steak, some kind of a raisin gravy. And then the next morning, we're coming in on the Southern, which, oh, by the way, is the same railroad tracks right by the house at D.C.
Really?
Yep.
Really?
Same set of tracks.
Weird.
Oh, I mean, how many times did we come across Interstate 70 and stop at the Sunoco station and the truck stop at 202? We probably did that 4 times.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
It was one of those places because when we were going back and forth, particularly between Omaha and Washington, we did that several times. And I don't know what other times when we were coming across 70. I'd have to think about the different trips. Huh? No, not in college. It was when your mother and I were, because we made that trip. We made 4 trips, well, 2 round trips between Washington and Omaha the 3 months we were out there, one out and back, and then we had to go back to Washington, which for most people was a big treat. I went back to Washington and didn't get TDY because that was supposedly my home base. And your mother didn't want to stay in Omaha by herself, and we wanted to look for housing anyway.
Uh-huh.
And a guy there lent us his townhouse on Capitol Hill. They were going to be gone for, he was near, he was gone, whatever, he let us use it. Maybe we stayed there, I don't remember. But, yeah, we stopped there multiple times. I remember driving by 70 and seeing the B-52s doing their touch and goes just like the 141s do now.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, went into Washington and we stayed at a hotel right down from the White House near the Court of Claims. And, I remember the first morning, Dad let me sleep in because I think we got in. We got in early in the morning. I don't know what we did the first day. But the next morning, I actually woke up and he'd already left to go to the court building. And there was instructions, and I think I was able to, I told him to get room service for breakfast. And I think then he told me I was allowed to give directions on how to get to the Court of Claims. It wasn't that far.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he came back and got me, but I remember going in. And there was this black man, very stereotypical, soft-spoken, southern, gentlemanly black figure, the uncle, the grandfather, if you want to go back to slave days, he was out. And he was the, like, sergeant of arms or something at the Court of Claims because I stayed with him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going in, he showed me around the courtroom when it was out of session, but I don't know that I sat in on the sessions when they were arguing, which probably wouldn't have meant much to me at the time. And I remember going to the Smithsonian when the Smithsonian was owning the red brick building, the castle, before he had all that other stuff. And they still had streetcars. Mm-hmm. There were streetcars all over D.C. And the cabs were cheap because they did it strictly by zones. And I remember Dad took me down to the marina area where they still have the seafood houses and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they actually, at the point, I think they still had real fishing boats coming in. And there were a lot of seafood bar and grill type places. Uh-huh. They were not fancy.
Right.
Because we went in, and the thing I liked was, of course, the only seafood I ate at the time was shrimp. Of course, Dad went in for the oysters. But they had the oyster crackers.
Uh-huh.
And I was just I ate my shrimp and, of course, then eating oyster crackers, which I thought was neat. And then we went from there. Instead of taking the train up, which I really kind of wasn't happy about, because we would have taken the Pennsylvania from, which would have taken, and those trains were really fast, fancy, even the coach. And because it was the congressional and the senator and these other, but people had come down from the academy for the case, and then we drove back to them to Kings Point. And from Kings Point, I got to spend two or three days there and saw Jeff Kirk and Ricky Black, Ricky Head, and I can't remember the other names right now. But Rick got to run around the academy, and then they took us into New York City, and we stayed at the Commodore Hotel, which was right next to, and you could walk to the New York Central, New York's Grand Central Station. Mm-hmm. And we stayed overnight. We got a hotel room. And I don't know why, because it's kind of odd. I don't know if they knew the snowstorm was coming or what was going on. But I remember there being a hell of a snowstorm. We were at the hotel, and then we took the train from New York Central to New York Central to St. Louis, which it splits in Cleveland, but we went up the Hudson River through Rochester, and I remember looking out at Rochester at the station when we stopped, and it was a major snowstorm, because we didn't run out of snow until we were cutting across Indiana and Illinois on our way to, I mean, it was a massive snowstorm. And, oh yeah, but I mean, I did mind. I thought, of course, I didn't get to play in snow. I got to look at it, is all. And there was a drunk on the train. I remember in Indiana or Illinois, somewhere, the train's hauling across the prairie, and he's trying to buy me a drink. I'm with my dad in the club car, and this guy, and a drink. And then we went to St. Louis and spent a day or two with him. Art in Florence, and then we got a real deal on the Missouri Pacific, because Dad wanted to go. He had made an appointment to go to the Air Force Academy, which had just opened. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was still mud, and they hadn't graduated their first class yet. I think the first class graduated like 59 or 60. And we took the MOPAC from St. Louis, and Dad, they had some kind of a deal. They owned their own Pullman cars. They weren't really, they're sleeper cars, because Pullman was a brand. And we actually got a double-deck sleeper, and it was a lot of fun, because they had dome cars, and there were all the college kids in the spring break time, and they were going out to go ski. And when we hit, I think it's Columbia, or one of those where the University of Missouri is, I mean, the trains, of course, Dad wouldn't let me go up to the dome car until the next morning. Then we got off in Denver early in the morning. I remember getting the station still there. They don't use it as a station. I don't think they have any passenger trains. It's now an Italian restaurant and stuff. But I remember getting there, and we walked up into downtown Colorado proper, and we went to a restaurant, well, a diner, or a, not a diner, but it was a a lunch place, I guess, anyway, it wasn't fancy.
Cafe,
there's the word. And these guys come in with, they look like they came right out of the movies. They had pistols on their hip and cowboy boots and hats and the whole nine yards. And people said, oh, don't ignore them. There was something going on. And they were excited, you know, wide-eyed. And then we took the bus out to the academy, which was some distance away. I mean, now, we haven't been out there, but I mean, the academy in Colorado Springs, there isn't a whole lot of north suburbs are out there now.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, they were smart enough. They bought plenty of land, so they're isolated. They're not going to. But we went out there, and I remember being, while Dad interviewed, they had a cadet take me around. No, he was interviewing the dean. He had some questions and specific things as part of his research for his dissertation. He was talking, I mean, I remember meeting the guy who was in an Air Force uniform, which impressed me, but then the guy, some student got stuck with me, some cadet, and he showed me the room, because I was impressed with him. The rooms had walnut doors. I mean, it was top notch when they built that place. I haven't been back to see the inside of it. But really nice, and I remember we got a picture somewhere, slides, with my bright red coat overlooking the Rampart Range and all that. Then we went back into Colorado Springs, took the Denver Rio Grande milk train up to Denver, spent the night with our cousins, my mom's cousins. Then we got on the Union Pacific in Denver, went to Cheyenne across Wyoming. Through Cheyenne, I remember going up over the, from Cheyenne over to Laramie, because that's quite, you know, that trip up, you've been on the car. And the train, it was snowing. Absolutely gorgeous. Stopped in Rock Springs, and we got into Salt Lake City, changed engine and stuff, got on the Southern Pacific, and went across the Great Salt Lake and across Nevada, and ended up going over the Sierras in the morning. All, you know, just loaded the snow. Got into San Francisco, spent the night, and that's when Dad took me to Fisherman's Wharf, to Tokyo Sukiyaki, which is right on Fisherman's Board. And we actually sat on the floor, and of course I had fried shrimp, but God knows what he had. And stayed in some hotel, and then we took the Coast Daylight the next day home. And of course, I was depressed now because he actually splurged, and we got what was called a first class seat, and we were in a lounge car with just chairs and stuff, and we were able to go back into the, what they call the drumhead with the finished train, where you have the window out the back. And of course, you got to see Vandenberg Air Force Base, and you could see the rocket engines. Because the train goes right through the Vandenberg, and of course, they couldn't stop the train and reroute it, so you could see this. I'm sure there were a lot of Russians when they could take the train. All that about the court case and all that. Favorite teachers. In high school, Bobby Father of Jero at Aquinas. He was soft-spoken Texan, fairly young, had just been ordained. Well, he was my homeroom teacher. I don't know if I actually even had him for class. It would have been English, something like that. I don't remember what he taught. I remember he was my homeroom teacher, because of course he was the first guy, priest I met when I, I mean, it's the guy I walked in the first day of school.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of the subject?
History.
What was the subject?
Well, Dad said, you know, we were talking about it, and, you know, well, what did I want to do? Well, I wasn't sure. Well, I really just wanted to go into the Navy. And I applied to the Merchant Marine Academy. And I was nominated, but the way they worked it with the Merchant Marine Academy, the congressman could nominate two or three from their district who are qualified, and then the academy got to pick. Didn't get the appointment, and then the academy had to take it. For whatever reason, they got to pick. Well, dad had won the court case by that point, court of appeals, or court of claims had found in their favor in 1960. By the time it was all settled, it was like 1960 or 61. And this would have been 1964. Well, I would have been applying in 63.
So the name James Walsh wasn't going over real well there.
Well, either. And when my dad was down there at a meeting, went out to the academy to see some friends, and they basically said, well, if he wants to apply again, he'll get in. But they wouldn't let me in the first time. I grew up at the academy. You gotta understand, I had free reign at the academy.
Mm-hmm.
They had guns. I mean, 5-inch and 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns that they used to train guys on. Jeff Kirk and I had to encourage them a little bit. But they had them set up along the gymnasium, outside the gymnasium. And I mean, I'd go down there dressed up with all my Army stuff. And I mean, they had training rifles, Springfield training rifles, which my sister walked off with mine and gave it to her son, and I never saw him. But, I mean, I had a full-size rifle that I carried around, and I conned them out of the cartridge belt. I still got that, the old web gear where you put the cartridges in with the clips and everything. Dad got me holsters. Well, I wanted to get a college degree first. I wasn't going in as an enlisted guy. I'd been trained, no difference. But and I ended up going to St. Joe's, which had no ROT. They had no.
Why did you go to St. Joe's?
I applied to three besides the academy. I applied to Rockport. Dad picked St. Joe's. We're talking, I mean, there was my sister had gone back to Minnesota to go, you know, and the deal was we'd lived on both coasts, and one of the things they said to consider was try the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a different perspective than living on the coast. And Norwich, which is a military-style academy, kind of like Texas A&M, but obviously immensely smaller, in Vermont. I had also applied, they have a corps of cadets and they wear uniforms and all that. I don't know if it's like A&M where they have a non-military or just non-military students. Of course, this was the 60s, which was still, there was another one, Vermont, it wasn't Middlebury. Anyway. I was accepted at Brockport, I was accepted at St. Joe's. Dad picked St. Joe's out because they were very innovative. They had gotten a grant from the Carnegie Foundation or someone, realizing that, they were transitioning from a strictly, highly religious faculty to a lot more as they had grown. You know, they couldn't do it all with just religious. And as a way to retain professors and encourage, get the professors where they might not be able to pay them. You know, you're an hour, 2 hours from Chicago, you're 2 hours from Indianapolis. Now Purdue's only an hour down the road, but, you know, unless you want to get a PhD in engineering or something, there's not a lot out there. And they got a grant from someone, and they took a portion of the college property, which was up actually in a beautifully, it's a wooded area up on a moraine. And they lent money to the professors to build houses at a low rate. And I think the only thing is that you had to sell it if you were leaving the college. You had to, I think, sell it to, I don't know how they worked it out. So they built like 10 or 15 houses like that. Dad had read about it, and he was very active in the AAUP, and he'd run across it at some point. He said, and it had a very good graduation rate, small school. I mean, it was only 1,200. Brockport at that point was already up to like 3,000. They were just starting they were transitioning from just being a teacher's college into, you know, the big university, full-fledged university. And, I mean, there was already a professor and his wife at Rockport. Dad knew from something that was obviously from being in Rochester. And they were gonna watch over me and have me over to the house. And I mean, you know, how far, we're talking 40 miles from Rochester. And that seemed a little close. And I also wanted to be able to play football, so I obviously wasn't going to go to a big university. And I didn't have any particular... away from home. Being free. And they had a... And I was interested in, I mean, I was also interested in the outdoors. And, you know, Dad said, you know, if you don't stay in the Navy, what do you want to do? And I thought, gee, I really, geology would give me a lot of options, you know, because I was then thinking about National Park Service, because, of course, I'd had a lot of good experiences with rangers and so on. And so he said, why don't you try the, you know, if you're interested, try the geology. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, he didn't tell me to do it, but we talked about it. Mm-hmm. And he said, try the geology because you'll get your science requirements out and you'll get your math requirements, because I had to start right in on algebra and all that, and eventually, you know, go into calculus. But I would get all my math and science requirements pretty much out of the way the first year. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't like it, I wouldn't have, because I still had to, yeah, I think I took history, I took the basic history course the first year or two. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, and they had a good department, small, but a pretty decent department. And I liked it. Stayed, of course, never used it after I got out directly, other than the photogrammetry courses. They call it photogrammetry because it gets into, it's a little bit more of the engineering, mathematics of it. Learning how to.
And they didn't have it very good.
Well, I mean, I had the one photogrammetry course. I mean, we're talking, it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, I took the graduate course at Catholic U when I was working as, you know, in the Army in Washington the first year for the first time. But it was, I mean, that was, I probably had as much as anyone had, unless you, I'm sure there were some universities that had some very highly technical stuff that may or may not have been written. You know, then you would be getting into geodesy and map making, and then it kind of loses it. It blurs into from geology into mathematics and all that kind of stuff.
And then graduated, and your mom went there, and then you joined the TCU.
We applied.
Did you join the ROTC?
Not right away. What was supposed to happen? I mean, I think your mother. Doc Sleeman conned me into going to grad school. I had already passed the preliminary exam for Navy flight training. Hadn't had the physical, but I didn't figure that was going to be a problem. But I had passed all the preliminary stuff and was qualified. Now, then you got to, I mean, it's not like I had a slot or anything, but I had already met with the recruiter, taken the exams, and had gotten it set up. And like I said, she conned me, she and Doc Sleeman. And I applied to, I don't know how I picked TCU out of the place. I think maybe, I just don't know how TCU came up. Going through the catalogs, I applied to the University of Alaska and Northern Illinois, which is up by Normal, probably about 90 miles west of Chicago. Would have been near Aunt May, actually. And TCU not only accepted me, they told me that after the first semester, they would, if I completed the first semester and passed my orals, I would be considered for an assistantship. They wouldn't give me an assistantship the first semester. And I got accepted there early, and of course, your mother could go to work for American Airlines down in Dallas. They had just moved. They had recently moved the headquarters formally from New York to Dallas-Fort Worth. The academy was down there, obviously had been there quite a while. And they had the reservations department because, of course, now your mother was, well, she didn't want to fly because she thought it was a long drive over to Dallas, not realizing that when she took the job, as a reservation. She was almost to Dallas anyway. It was at Amon Carter Field, which is directly due south of Dallas-Fort Worth Airport now, and it was literally in Dallas and Tarrant County. That was the first attempt at having a joint airport, because Love Field was very close to downtown Dallas, and there was a field, I forget what it was, over in Fort Worth that wasn't anywhere near as big. And they built Amon Carter Field smack dab on the county line as a way to, and it never really took off. When your mother was there, they had like, American had like two or three flights a day, which I knew about because that's when I was going to go down for her graduation, so she decided I could choose. That worked out, and I didn't hear from Northern Illinois, and all of a sudden, like in August, after everything was locked in, they said, hey, we'd love to have you come, and I don't know if they offered an assistantship or not, but we were locked in. And I got turned down by the University of Alaska, but that could have been a good deal for your mother, because she met the president of Alaskan Airlines on one of her American Airlines flights and gave her a card and said, if you come up, we'll be glad to give you a job. He didn't even specify what it was, but University of Alaska had a really top-notch program. I guess I just didn't qualify. I don't know if I ever would have. So we ended up down at TCU, and I just thinking about it, I just don't know how I picked out TCU. Went through a bunch of catalogs, and of course I think moving down in Texas sounded interesting. I'm sure your mother wasn't thrilled with the idea. I know she wasn't thrilled with the idea once she got there. Going from nice apartments into the student apartments and stuff with cockroaches and stuff like that.
And then when did you join the
Army? 9 months and 10 days after we were married, and 6 days or so after your sister was born. Of course, the doctor told your mother, oh, don't worry about birth control or anything at that point. Take care of it later, and obviously that didn't work, so you got pregnant on time. And I had, your mother had the baby on the 1st of April, and that week, immediately after that, maybe like, I don't know, whatever day, 3 or 4 days later, the American Society of Petroleum and Geologists and someone else had a major convention over in Dallas. And SMU and TCU were sponsoring it, or highly involved, and all graduate students were told to be there to be gophers. I spent 2 or 3 days sitting up on this scaffold with myself, and there was a geologist who worked for one of the petroleum companies. And my job was to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning, which was for an hour to an hour and a half drive over from Fort Worth to Dallas at the convention center, to be there for the breakfast for all the speakers. And they brought all of their slides, because of course no one had PowerPoint presentations then. We had to make sure the slides were in order and all that. We were gophers. And then we sat up in the scaffold all day long, while the operator, of course we weren't allowed to operate any equipment, it was a union job, I guess, but we had to make sure the slides were there for the right speaker and stuff. And of course your mother's, 3 days home from the hospital, and Aunt Patty had come down to help by that point. And the guy worked for Texas Instruments doing something with geology, I think it was, now that I think about it. Because he was an old guy. He was probably about 43, 44. And he was, of course, I had my lunch because I couldn't afford to buy anything. And of course, I was still probably getting 3 to 4 sandwiches a day and apples and stuff. And he said, oh, when you get older, you're never going to be able to eat that much. He says, I sometimes just have a single sandwich of fruit. And I thought, you've got to be out of your mind. How can you go all day without? I got back. And it was then the first day that we were going to have class after the convention. I don't know if it was a weekend or whatever. and I went down and I checked the mail, and I had a draft notice. And they kept changing the rules, you know, if you were in college, you got it, then if you're grad, if you were married, if you had a kid, whatever. Your mother was quite upset because Dad wouldn't do anything, and I didn't ask him to do anything to get out of it. Now, other guys, you know, oh, they got out of it for one reason or another. Your mother was quite bitter about that. She told your father that I ended up in Vietnam and didn't come home, and he was never, they would never see their grandchild. But I was teaching a freshman geology lab, and they were quite, I walked in the room because I called up and told the professor I had to go down, and I went down to the Navy recruiter to see if I could get into OCS or something, because I really didn't want to go into the grunt. And, you know, I was... Well, I've been drafted. You could go into basic training and hope you could then get into OCS, or you got into OCS before you got... You had some time. But anyway, I went down and saw the Navy recruiter, and I... The exam timed out, or they had changed the requirements, or there was something. It was stupid. I was short on sleep from getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and yada, yada, yada. And I think that was, just tired and, of course, a little bit stressed out. And I took the exam right then and there, and I failed to make it by like 2 points, you know, whatever it was. And I said, you know, what am I going to do? Well, of course, that was also, like, I think I was still trying to get into fly. I always liked to fly. I didn't know what I was going to do. And went back and went into class, whatever, the next day to teach. And the students were all concerned because if I left, they were going to get some full-time professor, and that made, I guess I was easy. Whatever, and I told him, you know, I wrote across the board, you know, there had just been a recent court ruling with two University of Texas law students had gone to court and said it was an undue hardship to be drafted and taken out of the middle of the semester, that they should be allowed to finish the semester because it was, you know, and the federal court had ruled, yep, you could be drafted, but you will be allowed to finish whatever the school term was. So I said, no, I will be here until June, and I'll finish out the thing. And it was a freshman, and I had a couple of seniors in it. And there were two guys in ROTC, and one of them was like a cadet commandant or whatever. And he said to me, he walked up after class, and he said, you got something against the military? And I said, oh. And I said, no. And he said, well, why didn't you get into ROTC if you want? And I said, because I'm married. And what had happened was, knowing what was going on, when I was in Rochester before we were getting married, I made the mistake of going to a Navy recruiter, what I should have done. U of R, I think, had a Navy ROTC program, and that's what I wanted to get into. And I knew SMU had one, and I figured, well, I'll drive over to Dallas, whatever, I was gonna look into it. But I went to the Navy recruiter down in downtown Rochester and told him what I wanted, and he said something about being married. He says, oh, you can't be in ROTC and be married. It's a crock of shit, obviously. So anyway, I said, well, I'm getting married in 2 weeks, thank you very much. And I think what he wanted was to get me sucked in and get me into Navy OCS, and they'll be very happy to fill his quota. So he, the ROTC guy looked at him and says, I'm married and I'm getting commissioned in three months or whatever. And I said, well, what do I need to do? He said, come on over and see the major. Or no, I guess it was Captain Crouch. And I told him, he was a great big armored cab officer. He's probably about 3 inches taller than I was. He probably was bigger than I am. And I remember we went over after class, and looked me right in the nose, you know, almost nose to nose, and said, are you serious about this? And I said, well, I've got my draft notice. What do you think? Be here tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. And they sent me over to Dallas for a physical, and they were having a big recruiting drive. And I got, you know, I mean, I passed with no problem. And in June, I was off to Fort Benning for basic training. Of course, we met Colonel. And then at the same time, I had also been accepted as the, I not only had my assistantship, the following year, I was made a dorm resident. I had Pete Wright dorm. And that's how we got to meet Colonel Divers, long before I actually met him as my ROTC commander. He had an office in the basement where the post office was, the school post office, and that's where your sister, your mother lost her. She was getting something, and all of a sudden Joanne was gone. And she sits in the basement. She's going up and down the basement, and all of a sudden she hears this, and it's, she walks in, and she's sitting on Colonel Divers' lap. And Divers was a real Virginia gentleman. He was an infantry officer, West Point graduate. Son was a West Point graduate. He was a Ranger. Had done one or two tours to Vietnam and ended up going into the Army. Well, the Army wouldn't let him go to medical school. He qualified for medical school. And I think they had actually started the military medical school at that point. But they wouldn't let him go. Said he was too old. The Air Force let him go. So he switched and went to the Air Force. And he went, I assume he completed it. Because it was really odd. He came in Air Force khakis with a combat infantry badge and a Ranger tab on his uniform, which was because he came in to give some thoughts when we were in ROTC. But that's how we got to know Colonel Divers. And then, of course, he had several daughters, and they babysat Joanne when there was an overlap during the summer when I was working construction and your mother had to leave. I mean, I came home and I got a full bird colonel sitting in the sandbox playing with Joanne. Kind of, we had a lot of, it really worked out. I mean, he was instrumental in making sure I got into intel. There was that, I told you the story about when I went up to Fort Sill the second time, and he did two things for us. The first time, you may want to plug your ears. Mary came up, and I actually went AWOL. And she ended up in the impact zone, and she was propositioned with your sister in arms. She may got in the wrong part of Fort, not Fort Sill, what was the name? Lawton.
Oh, that's where, is that in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
That's where Frank is.
He he went, it's our.
He wasn't allowed out of the house when they were there.
Not all of Lawton that was that way, but there was what they call the impact zone with the bars and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But because he went to artillery school.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, Mary.
What year was that?
Would have been 1970. Wait, 68? 60. I started graduate school in 68. Would have been 69? No, 70. I went to still. I went to Fort Benning in.
Yeah, they were there. Okay.
I was there in 70.
You went AWOL.
I went AWOL overnight because your mother was in town and she wanted. There was some deal. I don't know why they wouldn't let us out. We usually, but anyway, I actually hiked out over, went to the town, got to a state highway, got scared by a. Armadillo. God, I didn't know what the hell was roaming around there. Got on a road. Cops stopped me because someone had been doing something, and I got out of that. Someone gave me a ride into Lawton, found your mother in the motel. And of course, I hadn't made it in time, and you know, I was late, yada, yada, yada. And so, spent the night, and then she had to drive me in back, and I had to hike it back in, and of course, they did a tent check or a bed check because we were living in tents. And I had to tell them, I'd been over at another company visiting a friend and gotten drunk and just slept it off somewhere. They were not real happy about that. But anyway, that afternoon, Mary could come out to the place, and Colonel Divers took Joanne for a walk and let us have your mother have to use his office. First time I ever had sex in an armchair. Pretty big,
Oh dear, that's enough.
Yeah, well, because there was a knock on the door, and it was, I mean, Colonel Divers was the camp commander, the ROTC camp commander.
Uh-huh.
And he gave us our office, and fortunately, his aide did not come in.
Uh-huh.
But there was a knock on the door, because he was looking for Colonel Divers. And I said, he's not in here, because, God, I'd forgotten all about that. But anyway, then the following one was, a couple weeks later, 4th of July weekend or whatever, we were getting a 3-day weekend, and we were going to be allowed to go and take off. Well, some idiots had tried to go, they had gotten another weekend, and they had tried to go from Lawton, Oklahoma to New Orleans and back on a weekend, and they made it to within about 30 miles of the camp and then plowed into a railroad abutment and killed themselves. So we were out all week humping in the field. I had to keep hauling around an M60 machine gun. Mary had bought, I got a free ticket on Frontier Airlines on a 2-engine Convair turboprop. Same way I went up there. And it was leaving like at 6 o'clock. Well, the rule was if you weren't ready to go by 5 or something, there was a time limit that you could leave camp. And then you weren't allowed to leave until the next morning because they didn't want people driving all night killing themselves. Well, we got in late, yada, 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 and Colonel Divers had promised your mother I'd be home because your mother was a very, she didn't deal with this whole operation well at all. I think Ajita was now. So she ended up, I had to call her and say, hey, I can't leave till tomorrow morning. And so on, and there's nothing I could do about it. Well, Colonel Divers wasn't there. There was no, and I got to be careful. You just can't always be going to this colonel just because you're the, Colonel Divers had got home and he was sick. Your mother called. Of course, she had the phone number because her kid's babysat for us. And Mrs. Divers answered and said, I'd like to talk to Colonel Divers. I don't think she said who she was. And she started in, you goddamn lying son of a bitch. And I don't know if she didn't use fuck at that time, but she started in. Never said who she was. And all Colonel Divers said, calm down, Mary. Tell me what's going on. You lied to me. She said, so anyway, Colonel Divers called the camp. I had the airline ticket. I showed it to the sergeant or company commander. They weren't happy about it. But I had the ticket, so I was allowed to go to the airport. I got to the airport as the engines have started and they're getting ready to pull away. Now, we're not talking Dallas.
Right.
They wouldn't let me on the plane. They wouldn't stop it. This is not 1998
right.
when you have traffic control and stuff. So now I had to call your mother and tell her I missed the airplane. Of course, there's no more airplanes at 6 or 7 o'clock at night. So I said, I'll try and hitchhike. I will call you later. Well, I got really lucky. I had to walk out to the airport. Now I'm doing exactly what the Army doesn't want you to do. And I got a ride. I don't know if it was the first ride, but I eventually ended up with a truck driver who was going to Dallas. So we stopped somewhere for dinner, and I called your mother and said, okay, pick the town, meet me there, we'll be there at 11:30 at night or whatever the hell time, we've got to be late. So we drive along and we get into this town, and we had driven through it when she, I don't know how we did it the second time, anyway, no, we had never been in the town before, I guess. We drove to Lawton once or twice. Anyway, whatever the highway was like 287 or whatever, in the town it split into one-way streets. I mean, this is not a big town. And it's midnight and your mother's out there with Joanne. No, she didn't have Joanne because Evie was there. Evie had come down because I wasn't there to help with babysitting. So we had bought your mother a tear gas pistol because there had been some problems in the parking lot at the at Eamon Carter Field at the reservation thing. And she was sitting in, you know, in the middle of this little Texas town, and there were some high school kids or whatever, local, cruising, and they saw this young, pretty girl sitting in the car with, so it would have had Texas plates on it, fortunately not New York plates. But anyway, they started, you know, hey babe, yada, 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 and of course she can't find me, and I'm not sure, of course she's trying to time it with me. And they started to give her a ration, and she pulled out the pistol. Of course, it looks like a .22. And they disappeared, and of course, I come into town on the other street, and I can't find her, and of course, then I finally, the guy dropped me off, and I thought, well, she's just not here yet. And then it, somehow, it, I figured it out that it was, oh, wait, this is a one-way street, and she made, or maybe she drove around, but anyway, we did hook up. So. Yeah, well, that's the time she had that pistol on the plane the year before when she came to Fort Benning, and they had to do a check, and this is when the planes were being hijacked to Florida, or to Cuba, and she was on her way back, and they were doing a ticket check because they had a miscount, and she opened her purse, and of course the gun was in her purse. I mean, they weren't doing this kind of stuff like they do now. And she said the guy turned white, then he turned red, he turned white again, and he said, what's that? Is that what I think it is? And of course, your mother just pulls the purse out and says, yeah, don't worry, it's just, ma'am, please put it back in your purse. And I mean, here she is, she's on Delta Airlines on a non-revenue ticket, and of course, they escorted her off the plane, and she had to explain to them it's only tear gas, and she's an airline employee, and she doesn't want to go to Cuba, and so on, and this was in Atlanta. So. And that's the time I had to convince them that, I told you I'd probably tell you this story, so I'm going to tell them stories. We had picked that she would come in the middle of the tour, because I found out when at Fort Benning, we had a really enlightened group of cadre. They were all active duty Army, at least our drill sergeants were. Some of the officers were reservists, but a lot of our drill instructors were full-time, regular, basic training. And this guy had come back from Vietnam and said, listen, you guys are going to be officers in 2 years. I expect you, I'll treat you like those type of people if you perform that way. So the first thing we did is we brassoed all the pipes. I mean, all the pipes were exposed, so we had all these beautiful, shiny copper pipes. Some guy was an industrial artist or something. And we wrote up first, we got some machines, and we waxed all the floors, because I mean, these are World War II barracks, just wood frames with linoleum laid out or something resembling linoleum. It's green. And we did the seal of the United States on the first floor and the seal of the United States Army on the second floor, and we roped it off. So we were off every Saturday at noon. From noon until Sunday at whatever time we had to be back in, we were free to do what we wanted. So I told Mary, hey, this is great. You can fly down, but we'll split it in the middle. It'll be your birthday, July 20th. So she got the ticket and everything was all arranged. I had a hotel for it, downtown Columbus and everything. And this weekend they landed on the moon. And Nixon gave everyone off Monday. They were gonna land Sunday. Maybe they're landing Monday, I don't know, whatever the deal was. But we got a day off. Well, the Army did a lot for a day off. And so instead of what they were doing on Monday, they were going to cram into at least part of it into Saturday afternoon. And they told us this, you know, like Friday night. And I mean, I didn't even call her and tell her. I didn't know what I was going to do. So first thing, bright morning, 5 o'clock in the morning when we got up after breakfast, or maybe even before breakfast, I went in and went to see the first sergeant, who was a short little Italian from New York. And, you know, walked in, saluted, and said, you know, first sergeant, request permission to talk to company commander. What's so important that you need to talk to the company commander? Need permission to take the afternoon off. What's so important that you're going to miss field fortifications? I said, first sergeant, in anticipation of having the weekend off, my wife is flying in from Dallas, Texas for the weekend. Didn't know we were going to land on the moon. I'll talk to the command. I'll talk to the company command. By God, the son of a bitch let me handle it.
Really?
We were out doing our calisthenics and running, and I remember he came out and said, report to, or report back to the barracks at 1,200 hours. You can have leave. So, very fortunate. Of course, then we had to, I remember laying in bed listening to him. I didn't see much of the teaching program, but we heard, we had the TV on. We were listening to him. And laying it on the moon. I think there are other more important things than that. But, those are the war stories in ROTC.
That's kind of Do you have a nickname
for
your
grown-up? Nope.
Jimmy Joe.
They
call you Jimmy?
Jimmy. I don't think anyone calls me Jimmy. Yeah, some of my cousins in St. Louis, I think, call me Jimmy Joe. I don't know if the ones in Ohio do or not, but it's pretty much Jimmy. I didn't have a nickname. I didn't pick up JJ till I was here probably 8 years. And it was only because there were six or seven gyms in the office, and I took to initialing all the stuff that, you know, that you have